Dr. Nick Patras.
I'm the director of the Counseling Center, so that's the Student Counseling Center on campus.
You counsel students?
Yes.
And your team counsels students?
Only students, correct. We are here, we are part of Student Affairs Division, Campus Life and Student Development, and our mission is to serve students.
The Send Silence Packing event, presumably it's an event, it's an installment, right? It's an art installation.
It's an exhibition, it's an exhibit, a traveling exhibit, award-winning, put together by the Active Minds National Office, travels around the country to college campuses, bringing awareness to mental health on college campuses, suicide prevention, decreasing stigma associated with mental health on college campuses.
What's it designed to do?
It basically stimulates some pretty heavy-duty conversations. These backpacks, many of them still have the contents that the student who took their life had in their backpack the day they took their life. And so they're very personalized. Many of them have pictures of students on them. And so there'll be approximately 1,100 backpacks set up on the campus. And the goal, why we're bringing this exhibit to the campus is to have our students, faculty, and staff walk through the exhibit, take some time to read those individual stories, and then continue the dialogue, because we really feel like we have been intentional since early 2018. What does mental health look like on our campus? What are the resources available? What is the awareness of and utilization of the resources that are available? And then a byproduct of that conversation is, what else can we be doing? What else should we be doing? What else ought we be doing?
In the context of these backpacks being spread across presumably a lawn, I've seen photographs, students are able to experience this when they walk by. Well, anyone, students just happen to be one of many people. Anybody who happens to be walking by will
see
it.
On the campus.
The idea being that it sparks presumably a conversation, presumably an unguided conversation.
Correct. We will have both Counseling Center staff, our full office of eight will be out there on site throughout the day, as well as over 100 volunteers who've signed up to be a part of this. And those volunteers, along with the professional staff, will answer questions. Obviously, if we see someone who is overly distressed, we'll be able to make sure that they get the services and the help that they need. And then we've created four debrief sessions starting the next day, two on Tuesday, one on Wednesday, one on Thursday. And people will literally be able to do a scan code and sign up for one of those debrief sessions if they want a more formalized, in a group of 25, debriefing session. What did I get from this? What has this brought up for me? These are the questions I have about our campus. These are the questions I have about mental health and what's preventing people from seeking help, all of those things. If they want to have those formalized conversations, we have some formats for that set up, as well as many informal conversations. We hope there'll be just as many informal conversations.
I would think that they'd have to be.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, everybody is going to see this, and a lot of folks who might not be ready to engage or want to engage in that way are going to be able to see it. What does, on the back end of this installation and the back end of those informal conversations, the back end of all of this, what does the campus climate, the student climate, look like with regard to conversations about mental health in contrast with what it looks like now? What are you hoping for?
I think as a professional, I have a view of what mental health looks like on our campus. We pride ourselves on providing a very superior level of service. But I also would like to hear what the students are perceiving the services are. What are they seeing? What are they seeing as a barrier to preventing them from coming in? I have had people sit in my office, in my chair, 3 weeks before graduation and say, wow, I wish I'd have known this was here when I first got here. And that's heartbreaking.
Sure.
But it does happen. Even though we're a part of orientation and we feel like we do about probably 6,000 contacts in an academic year with students around educational outreach of all different types. Each of those is an opportunity to educate a student that we're here. We're here for you, exclusively for you. And yet there are still students who do not know we exist until they're ready to leave the campus.
So it seems like then one goal might be when students encounter what might predictably be an overwhelming emotion with regard to suicide, that perhaps they'll seek out or be receptive to information that we have this resource on campus.
And Jared, probably even more so, we hope that they become aware if they're dealing with anxiety, stress, depression, a family situation, a financial situation, that they will come seek help before it ever gets to the point where the thought is contemplating suicide.
Right. So can we veer off a little bit?
Sure.
Well, all of this is in the context that we are sort of accepting that science says that when people feel like they can talk about these things, when they feel like they can be heard about these things, that more desirable outcomes are likely. That science is pretty solid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And yet probably the number one question that I'm asked, I would say over the last 3 to 4 years, is why is there so much suicide in this population? And I typically pull out my cell phone and hold it up, because not that device is the cause of it, but what that device, how that device has become such a critical part of our lives, and in particular, I'm going to pick on social media, that defines who we are in many cases now. It is such a part, and the students that are here today, they've never not known having a cell phone. They've never not known having a social media account and X number of followers. I mean, I've literally heard a student say, I have 1,000 followers and I don't have a single friend. That's sad.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, trying to find a way to break through that dilemma, so that if I already don't know how to have a personal relationship because it's all been socially mediated through a device, now I have to learn to trust a professional, which kind of already there's some stigma attached with going to a professional to seek help.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to find a way. What's the workaround around that? How can we help students realize that, A, counselors don't tell them what to do. Counselors don't, quote-unquote, I'm using air quotes, you know, think you're crazy.
Right.
But that it is an opportunity to have another human being on a journey with you that has your best interest 100% of the focus each and every time you're sitting in front of that professional.
I got two then follow-ups, and one, both of them in the realm of social media. I just saw an article published by allaccess.com, which is a industry rag for broadcast, mm-hmm. but somebody mentioned just kind of where folks are spending their time. A lot of times we're talking about percentage and share of audience. And what I learned from that report was something on the order of 18.1 million people were logged in and scrolling through Facebook over the past 60 seconds, that it's somewhere north of 4 or 5 million people scrolling through Instagram. How much responsibility do you think that these social media sites that have sort of created this environment and this culture, how much responsibility do you think they bear? Do you think there's a way that we could potentially assign some responsibility and leverage the billions of dollars that these social media companies are worth in order to help combat this societal image problem that we're developing?
My better angels would hope that we could. We still haven't In the United States, we still haven't solved the problem of how much of our private world we freely grant to those companies. I mean, it's completely unregulated in the United States versus in Europe, as I understand it, it's much more highly regulated what information they can gather from us and then share with other people, sell to other people. So I'm not sure how committed those companies are, Facebook, others, at this point in time are to doing that piece for better social.
Well, it seems like at some point somebody will have to connect the dot between, yeah. you know, perhaps higher depression rates and all of the undesirable outcomes therein, to the fact that they are freely helping to share what could be potentially false and unattainable yes, imagery for absolutely. People to develop a longing for.
And as you know, this is not new. It's right. a different medium. I mean,
it's just the latest iteration.
We used to look at magazines and go, oh, I should look this way. Now it's our device.
Right, right. The other question with regard to social media that I developed while you were answering before was, has the conversation been watered down by what appears to be an uptick in the use of language that might have indicated prior to social media that there's a problem worth looking at? When I say that, I mean, I oftentimes will see tweets or Facebook posts where someone sort of out of context posts an image that sort of states a condition that they're dealing with, and then they'll say something like, I just can't. And I think that if somebody were to walk up to you on the street and they looked at you and they said, I just can't, I feel like that might trigger a response that you're sort of prone to do, but now we're sort of using those responses, or I feel triggered. Like these sort of things are now being tossed out flippantly. Does that water down the conversation to make it somewhat meaningless when social media is where a lot of these conversations are happening?
I mean, in my judgment, I would have to say yes, I think it does. It has watered it down. We also deal with a generation who, and it's on that same continuum, a generation who at the drop of the hat will say, I'm going to take my life. I'm dealing with a failed course. I'm going to take my life. And so there's that resilience piece. There's that, how did we lose that ability to take a difficult situation and realize I can still deal with this and I'm going to be okay. And now the immediate, almost immediate response in many cases is I'm going to end my life.
That's unfortunate.
It is very unfortunate. And the unknown is if the student acts in an impulsive way, Maybe they didn't fully intend to end their life, but the impulsivity added with that lack of impulse control and I don't like this situation and I'm going to do something can have very dire consequences.
Do you think outcomes are better if folks in your profession, the mental health profession, are able to introduce perspective that maybe was missing for these students?
Well, and that's In the programming and planning that we do every day and for every academic year, we're constantly looking for how can we give to these students what normally they would have come to a campus with mm-hmm. generations ago. You know, I don't want to date myself, but it's a lot of years ago, no matter what you threw at me, I may not like it. I may not be okay with it. I may complain and raise all kinds of heck, but I would have likely not ever said, I'm going to kill myself over this situation. And so now we're trying to figure out what are the things that we can do skill-wise, emotional control-wise, how do I learn to regulate my emotions where perhaps I didn't get that in my formative years.
Right. And what is sort of causing that? I imagine it like a train that's moving and that's the last stop. And what brought that last stop so much closer to yeah. where the train is now than it would have been in the past? Because I think that I'm in a similar boat. I think that I've, you know, but I don't know that the challenges with which I've dealt are the kinds of challenges that might lead a person to think that. I just know that I'd like to think that I'll maintain a level head and say, you know, whatever this is, we're going to try to get through it. Yeah. But I don't know what causes a person to already feel like they're well beyond that yeah. point. And I think that you guys doing things like this, having these conversations or attempting in a roundabout way to force these conversations mm-hmm. Will at the very least help to develop a little bit better picture about why this is happening and hopefully somebody gains something positive from it.
Absolutely. And if nothing else, build a culture on a campus that it even if that particular student who's in a difficult situation can't ask for or reach out for the help, there's enough of a culture of support that someone else will recognize, okay, someone's really in trouble here. Let me act to do something.
Can I shift gears violently?
Certainly.
An event happened in spring 2016 that had a pretty massive impact, I think, on sort of the emotional calmness of and pastoral nature of Northeast Texas, and more mm-hmm. specifically here on the campus of A&M Commerce. A lot of the people, students particularly, who were old enough to understand the implications of this have graduated. But there remains, the lingering feeling remains in the faculty and in the staff that are here, that have been here for a lot of years. This sort of lack of understanding coupled with, you know, a lot of, I'm not going to call it interference, but a lot of conversation that sort of leads to the idea that talking about these things can help to limit, you know, these negative outcomes. And in the same context, knowing that this thing that happened in 2016, that the person began a conversation with the public 5 days prior, mm-hmm. openly owned the situation that they were in, and it still had this negative outcome. And I only say that to say, I think that resources of the nature that you guys provide to students, I think would be valuable to faculty and staff here on campus as an employee benefit, or even to the wider community, which I think it, you know, in some cases it is, but anecdotally I've heard that the sort of help in terms of mental help here in this region is woefully low.
Yes.
And in this Texas. Institution has an opportunity to provide something like that, to you know, sandbox something like that for the region. And I think that faculty staff might be a great place to start.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think the incident that we're speaking of had a profound ripple effect, continues to have a ripple effect on the campus community, the greater Northeast Texas area, and from that loss, I think we're looking for ways as to how our institution can change what is a fact that in Northeast Texas and in Texas in general, we don't do a good job with mental health. We're second to last as far as the ways that we handle the mental health of our population. And I think in particular, a rural area is especially hard hit because people who go to school, get trained, get their license, typically gravitate to larger areas where it's easier to find employment, build a private practice and whatnot. And so that leaves the rural areas severely challenged with having appropriately trained professionals. And then you have the secondary problem, and you can't ignore it, is the fact that it still costs money for mental health care. And if someone doesn't have the funds, then how is that delivered? And so there's a public health issue. There is still the stigma that mental health is looked at and viewed very differently than physical health. And my goal, my hope is that people can treat mental health on the same parity as physical health. It is important. It's valuable that we take care of it.
Well, the sort of conversations that you are instigating by bringing this Send Silence Packing event to campus, which will be March 11th, I think that's exactly the jumping off point that we need in order to bring this back into the mainstream.
Excellent. Yes. We look forward to continuing the conversation.
Dr. Patras, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Jerry.